Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Every principal will tell you how distinctive their school is. But at the end of the day, schools have a lot of similarities. Grades and classes and desks and textbooks. But, and this is kind of a radical notion, maybe we don't need any of those things. Maybe schools need an extreme makeover, a total rejection of structure. Peter Gray says research shows that's exactly what works best. He's the author of Free to Learn, Why Unleashing the Instinct to Play Will Make Our Children Happier, More Self-Reliant, and Better Students for Life. And he's a professor at Boston College. Peter, happy to have you here.
I'm very happy to be here, Kara.
We're going to talk about play and the role that you think it should have in students' lives. But we are in this culture where a lot of kids' time is scheduled now. Have you seen that change over time? Is that a positive direction we're going in?
Yeah, I've seen that change over time in my lifetime very clearly. More and more time is being spent in school, more and more time doing homework, and even out of school, children are spending more and more time at adult-directed activities that are somewhat school-like. In my book, I document this decline, and I also make the case that over this same period of time, there's been a dramatic increase in anxiety disorders among children, in depression among children. There's been a decrease in creativity. There's been a decrease in the sense to which people feel in control of their own lives. There's been an increase in narcissism. I argue that these are all the result of the restrictive lives that children have to live these days.
Let's talk about why, in a sort of evolutionary sense, play is the direction we should be pushing kids. It seems like building up a roster of skills is the direction that society has been going.
That's right. Well, what are the skills that people need for success in life? In this day and age, you don't need to hold a lot of information in your mind. You've got Google for that, right? You don't need to train people to do routine tasks that robots can do, right? But you know, we really need more people who know how to get along with people. We need more people who know how to solve the problems of life. These are not things that can be taught in school. These are things that you have to learn through experience. And where do children get that experience? They get it in play, where there's no adult solving their problems for them, and they have to solve their problems. They have to create the answers to the problems that arise. They have to figure out how to get along with that kid who's a little tough to get along with. That's always in the past how children learn the really important life skills. You know, some of my research has been to look at the lives of children in hunter-gatherer cultures. Not directly. I've never had the opportunity to live in a hunter-gatherer culture myself, but I've interviewed and surveyed anthropologists who have. And here's the amazing thing. In every single one of these cultures, the anthropologists tell me that the children are allowed to play and explore from dawn to dusk, from the time that they're about 4 years old, when they're deemed old enough and mature enough to move on away from their moms and play with in age-mixed groups with the other kids on into their mid to late teens. And why, if you ask the parents, you say, this is how the children learn the kinds of skills that they need to become adults. It's how they practice the social values. It's how they practice getting along with another. It's also how they practice, because they look around, they see what the skills are that you have to learn to be successful in your culture, and they practice those skills, not because anybody's making them do it, but because it's human nature to want to become good at what you see are the important skills around you in the world. So, you know, this is really the first time, except for times of slavery or times of intense child labor, this is the first time in history that large numbers of children are not having the opportunity to play and explore freely on their own and to develop the kinds of skills that can really only be developed in that sort of way.
But if you look back in history, children did have the opportunity to follow around a parent if a parent was a bread baker or a cobbler or hunting or making a canoe or whatever. We don't live in that kind of society. If your kids want to come with you to work, largely they cannot do that, even if you want your kids to come with you to work, right? That would not be tolerated in a workplace. So how do you think about reinventing schools if what's most important for kids to be creative and innovative is play?
Yeah, well, it's very interesting that you should ask that, because I've actually, in addition to looking into the lives of hunter-gatherer children, I've also done research at a remarkably alternative school that's actually located not that far from here in Framingham, Massachusetts, called the Sudbury Valley School. There's quite a number. There's about 24 other schools in this country, maybe a dozen elsewhere, modeled after Sudbury Valley. This is a school really and truly where children are free to play and explore and follow their own interests all day long. The children enroll as early as age 4. They're there on through what we normally in our society think of as high school age. They mix freely across age, and they have plenty of learning opportunities there. There's about 150 students there, all interested in different things. There's a number of staff members who have different interests and skills. There's lots of opportunity to use the tools of the culture. So this, in a certain sense, is the equivalent of a hunter-gatherer band for children today. They've got all this whole range of age of kids doing very interesting things. They see different kinds of activities. They can follow their own interests. And in many cases, they're going on to adult careers that are really extensions of what they played at.
Let me understand the model here. Kids come to school.
Yeah.
There's no math class.
Right.
There's no English class. There's
right.
no biology class. None of that.
Right.
There's just sort of activities set out for them that they can do if they want or not. How does that push you towards becoming a doctor or a lawyer or finding that passion? I mean, that seems like you're sort of leaving kids adrift.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds almost sinful, right? I mean, it so violates what we think of that school should be, right? But, you know, the philosophy of the school is you don't push kids. Kids pull themselves. Look at any little child before they ever start school. Look how motivated they are. They're so curious. You can't stop them from learning. They look into everything, any new thing. They want to understand it. They want to knock things off the table to see what happens. Once they've got language, which, by the way, they learn without being taught, once they've got language, they're full of questions using language. You know, what would happen if you didn't stop that? What would happen if you provided a setting in which young people could continue learning in that same self-motivated way?
So if you have studied this particular school and then schools around the country where people use the sort of play model, figure out what you're interested in and go pursue it, I'm interested in what happens to those kids. Can they get into college? Do they want to go to college? Do they get regular jobs? I mean, if I was a parent thinking about sending my 5-year-old off to a totally different kind of school, that's what I'd be interested in knowing. That's
exactly what any parent would be interested in knowing. And in fact, I first got involved with this school and with this entire question of children's education and development when my own son rebelled in public school many, many years ago. And we found Sudbury Valley School as a place for him, and he loved it. He was just delighted, and I could see how happy he was and how his bright eyes came back again, his own curiosity. But I began to wonder, is he going to, in the long run, be cutting his options short in some way? Would he be able to go on to college if he wanted to go on to college? He was only 9 years old, or maybe 10 years old when he started. So that led me to ask exactly the same question you just asked, and then to answer it by doing a study of the graduates of the school. Already at that time, there were about 100 people who qualified as graduates, who left at typical age for leaving high school, didn't go on to secondary school someplace else, went on to life. And some of them had done all of their prior education at the school, never been to a regular school. And I looked into what they were now doing. And Interestingly, quite a number of them, more than half of them, had gone on to college at a time when about half of the general population from that socioeconomic group was going on to college. They didn't seem to have any difficulty getting into college, believe it or not, and they did very well in college. And when I asked them, how did they manage, you know, when they didn't have the same subjects? They hadn't, you know, might be in a biology class. They've never formally studied biology.
That's right.
Before.
All of a sudden, they're in school with kids who've had these very rigorous educations.
They've had this very rigorous education. Well, there's kind of two answers to that question. One is, despite the rigorous education, the kids didn't really know much biology or whatever it was. You know, we think of it as a rigorous education, but it's taught in a way that sort of you're being taught in a kind of rote way. You're being tested on memorized answers and you forget it. But secondly, and probably more important, these students were making a deliberate choice to go to college. They were making an adult-like decision. Nobody was telling them that college is where you're supposed to go. That, I mean, these, after all, they're from families that weren't pushing them through the regular school. They're not pushing them into college either. They're going to college because they have made a decision to go to college, and they are used to being in a situation where they're taking responsibility for themselves.
You talked about your son being the reason that you started on this whole track of researching the role of play in education. What happened? Why didn't he like public school?
He, from almost day one in kindergarten, I mean, he went off to school really excited the first day and the first few days. He thought, oh, this is going to be wonderful, a place to learn and play. Went off to a place where there's going to be a lot of kids and it'll be so much fun. And he was so disappointed. He found it really stifling. He found it burdensome to have to spend so much time sitting. He found he didn't like to have to do just exactly what everybody else was doing at the same time that they were doing it. How can you be creative if that's the fundamental rule and that's the way school works? Well, he found ways of trying to make it creative. So the teacher would teach one way to do an arithmetic problem and he would invent a different way to do it. But then the teacher marked it wrong, not because he got the wrong answer, but because he did it the, quote, wrong way. And so even his attempts to try to turn this into something interesting failed, and he was constantly being criticized. So, you know, we reached a kind of crisis point where we met in the principal's office, the principal of the school, the assistant principal, the school guidance counselor, a child psychologist brought in from outside, his teacher, his mother, and me, we were all going to tell him in no uncertain terms that he had to follow the rules of school. Well, he looked at us all, and I hope I can say this, but he said, go to hell. And I began to cry, and his mother began to cry, and we realized we had to be on his side. And that's when we decided we really had to take him out of that school, and we found Sudbury Valley. Now, he's an extreme example of somebody who was really rebelling in public school, but I think there are a lot of other examples who don't even recognize that they're rebelling, who are similarly having their creativity stifled, and we need to find something different for them.
Peter Gray is a research professor at Boston College. He's the author of Free to Learn. Peter Gray, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Express yourself. Express yourself. You don't never need help from nobody else. All you got to do now.
And finally, if you did go to a traditional school somewhere along the line, what was the best class you ever took? Tweet us at iHubRadio. We've also gathered all the people who work on this show, including our interns who are still in school, to tell us what their favorite class was. Producer Mary Dew?
I'm going to say historically it was always Latin, but then individual class of all time would be History of New York with Kenneth Jackson.
Associate producer Mark Solinger?
Radio production with the incomparable Douglas Quinn in Syracuse.
Explains why you're here.
Exactly.
Associate producer Matt Purdy.
10th grade drama with Sherry Morrison.
Intern Dana Guth.
Science of the Human Experience with Professor Jonathan Garlick.
Intern Greta Yoakum.
Introduction to Journalism with Neil Miller.
Engineer Alan Mattis.
Well, my best class was high school band with Ernie Behrens, not only because we were an award-winning band and I sat lead chair, but he taught me how to listen, started me on my audio career.
And my favorite class was 9th grade English with Todd Jesdale. Special thanks today to KUHF's Laura Eisensee and KCUR's Kyle Palmer in Houston and Kansas City for gathering thoughts from high school students on what they think about education. Remember, you can always find and share segments of our show on iTunes and SoundCloud. And tune in every week for stories about innovative people, innovative ideas, and how to become more innovative yourself. From PRI and WGBH Radio, I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
PRI, Public Radio International.